The first time I noticed the red light, I told myself it was nothing. A harmless habit, a little tech obsession, a modern version of sticky notes and spreadsheets. I'd worked with men who loved systems more than people, men who measured trust like a KPI. It wasn't my first corporate weirdness, and it wouldn't be my last, but the red light kept showing up. On his phone during our one-on-ones, on his laptop during quick check-ins, on a tiny device clipped to his bag strap when he walked me to the elevator, like we were friends and not two people locked in the same professional cage. He said it was for accountability. He said it protected both of us. He said it kept things clean. Then I found out how far back his records went, how wide they reached, how many people were in his private archive without knowing. And the worst part wasn't that he had recorded me. It was realizing he had already decided I would be the problem. I was hired into the Berlin office because I knew how to stabilize chaos without making a scene. That was my reputation. The woman you bring in when a team is melting down, but you don't want a formal investigation. The person who can sit in a room with egos and fear and still translate it into workable steps. I had spent years inside different workplaces, and the pattern was always the same. People don't quit jobs, they quit the small humiliations that pile up until they can't breathe. This company wasn't glamorous, but it was well-funded. A European tech services firm that sold digital transformation to older industries. Manufacturing, logistics, public infrastructure. We were the polished middle layer between executives who wanted innovation and employees who were tired of being told their work was obsolete. The Berlin office had the usual mix of ambition and exhaustion. Bright meeting rooms, cheap coffee, expensive consultants rotating in and out like weather. My role was officially operations program lead. Unofficially, I was damage control. I was there to streamline project delivery, clean up reporting, and stop client escalations from turning into board-level embarrassment. I reported to the head of delivery, a white German man named Marcus, who had been with the company long enough to speak in acronyms without realizing it. Marcus was the kind of man who didn't raise his voice. He didn't need to. He used calmness like a weapon. He smiled in a way that never reached his eyes. He could turn a compliment into a trap and make you thank him for it. The first week I met him, he praised my background in front of other managers, then immediately assigned me the most politically rotten initiative in the office. He called it a great opportunity. It was a mess, a contract that had been oversold, a client that was furious, and a project team that had stopped trusting leadership. The timeline was impossible. The budget was a lie. The documentation was a patchwork of excuses. Marcus's management style was pure plausible deniability. He loved alignment meetings and hated written commitments. He wanted decisions made verbally, in rooms with no minutes, so no one could quote him later. He also had a habit of collecting other people's mistakes the way some people collect vintage watches, patiently, with pride, and always ready to show them off when the moment was right. That was the dynamic I stepped into, a company that marketed clarity while operating on ambiguity, a workplace where everyone smiled while counting each other's weaknesses. At first, Marcus seemed unusually supportive. He gave me access to the right dashboards, introduced me to key stakeholders, and told me I could challenge things openly. He said he wanted transparency. He said he wanted honesty. He said he'd rather hear hard truths than comforting lies. I had learned by then that the men who say that are often the ones who punish you most for believing them. The first warning sign came in a small moment. We were in a glass meeting room, late afternoon, the office starting to thin out. The light was that gray, Berlin winter light that makes everything look slightly tired. Marcus asked me how I thought the project recovery was going. I gave him the truth. Not dramatic, not emotional, just operational reality. We needed a scope reset. The client needed a new governance model, and leadership needed to stop promising outcomes we couldn't deliver. He nodded. He asked follow-up questions. He took notes. Then I noticed his phone on the table, face up. The screen was dark, but there was a tiny red dot near the top. I'd seen it before on my own phone during a voice memo, a recording indicator. I paused mid-sentence without meaning to. My brain caught up a second later and my stomach tightened. I looked at him and he met my eyes with that calm expression. like I was the one being strange. I didn't accuse him. I didn't want to look paranoid. I kept speaking, but my words got careful. Suddenly, I was editing myself in real time, and I hated how fast it happened. I hated how instinctive it was, like my body already knew something my mind hadn't accepted. When I finally stopped, Marcus tapped his screen, and the red dot disappeared. "You're very direct," he said, like it was a compliment. "I appreciate it. This is exactly why I like to keep records." "Records," I repeated. "For accountability," he said. "Just so we don't misremember. People always misremember, especially when things get tense." He smiled again, calm, reasonable, professional. I tried to match his tone, but my voice came out flatter than I intended. "You recorded that?" "Yes," he said easily. "Only internally, only for me. It protects both of us." Both of us, that phrase, it sounded like fairness, it sounded like balance, but it landed like a warning. I told myself to stay calm. I told myself it might be legal. I told myself I didn't want to make a scene. I told myself that if I made it a problem, it would become my problem. "Still," I said, "I would prefer to know beforehand." Marcus tilted his head slightly. "You do know, now you do, and now you can relax." That was the thing about him. He could say something deeply controlling and frame it as comfort. After that, I started noticing the red light more often. It became part of our rhythm. Anytime we spoke alone, his phone would appear, face up, within reach. In the beginning, I tried to pretend I didn't care, but my body reacted anyway. Shoulders tighter, breath shallower, sentences shorter. I started choosing words like I was stepping through broken glass. It wasn't just about privacy, it was about power. Recording made every conversation feel like evidence. Like I was already on trial, even when nothing was wrong. Like my job wasn't to do the work, but to avoid being captured doing the wrong thing. One afternoon, he called me into his office for a quick check-in. Marcus's office was small and unusually tidy, with a single framed print of a black and white cityscape that made the room feel colder than it needed to. He shut the door gently, like it was a courtesy. He asked about a client escalation. I explained what had happened. I owned my part without dramatizing it. I said what I would fix. I suggested next steps. He listened, nodding. His hand rested on his laptop trackpad, and I noticed the little microphone icon in the corner of his screen. The same kind of indicator, a recording app, a meeting transcription tool. I stopped and looked at it. He followed my gaze and didn't even blink. "It helps me capture details," he said. "You're very thorough, but people twist words. This keeps it clean." Clean, he loved that word. Clean implied that without his system, things would be messy, emotional, unreliable. It implied that my memory and my integrity were less trustworthy than his archive. I could feel myself getting angry, but anger in offices like that is always expensive, especially for a woman. You pay for it in reputation and opportunity. You pay for it in how people describe you when you're not in the room. So I kept my voice neutral. "Do you record everyone like this?" He leaned back slightly, hands folded. "Only when it's important." "And who decides what's important?" I asked. Marcus smiled again. "I do." It was said like a joke, but it wasn't. I left his office feeling like I'd swallowed metal. The hallway lights were too bright, the open plan office too loud. I watched people at their desks typing and laughing and complaining about deadlines, and I wondered how many of them had their own red lights following them around without noticing. In the following weeks, Marcus became more present in my day than he needed to be. He asked for frequent updates. He scheduled short meetings that could have been emails. He wanted conversations instead of written summaries, which would have been normal if he wasn't recording the conversations. It was like he wanted control over the context. He wanted the sound of my voice, my pauses, my tone. And I started to understand something I didn't want to admit. Marcus wasn't recording because he feared mistakes. He was recording because he expected conflict. He expected someone to challenge him, and he wanted to win before the argument even started. That's what insurance is. You don't buy it for the sunny days. You buy it because you assume something will burn. The office culture made it worse. There was a soft loyalty to Marcus that I couldn't quite map. People respected him. People feared him. People also seemed to see him as the stable center of the office, which meant they ignored the damage he caused at the edges. He kept everything running smoothly enough that no one wanted to inspect the cost. I tried to tell myself I could manage it. I'd dealt with difficult managers before. I'd navigated politics and pettiness and quiet intimidation. I knew how to document, how to build alliances, how to keep my work clean. But this was different, because he was already documenting me in his own way. He was building a version of reality where he held the proof. The first time I spoke to HR about it, I didn't even frame it as a complaint. I asked as if it were a policy question. Is it allowed for a manager to record internal meetings without consent? I asked, trying to sound casual, like I was curious, not scared. The HR business partner, a woman named Sabine, paused in that careful way HR people pause. She asked what kind of recordings, audio, video, transcriptions. Audio, I said, sometimes transcriptions. Sabine frowned slightly. We encourage transparency, but recording without explicit consent is tricky. Tricky. That's what HR says when something is wrong, but politically inconvenient. Should I report it? I asked. Sabine looked at me with sympathy that didn't reach action. Maybe try to resolve it directly first. Sometimes people don't realize how it comes across. I almost laughed. Marcus realized that was the whole point, but I nodded. I said I would handle it. I walked back to my desk and sat down and stared at my screen, feeling my pulse in my throat. That was the beginning of the trap. The moment where I understood that if I pushed too hard, I would become the difficult one, the sensitive one, the one who couldn't handle modern tools, the one who made accusations. And Marcus, calm Marcus, would have his archive ready. Once you start living inside someone else's documentation, you begin to change shape. You become a smaller version of yourself. You stop improvising. You stop thinking out loud. You stop using humor to relieve tension. You become careful, because careful is safer, and safety becomes the only thing you can focus on. That's what happened to me. Marcus's recordings didn't just capture meetings. They reshaped them. They turned every conversation into performance, and he controlled the stage. At first, I tried to set boundaries politely. I asked for notice before recording. I asked for written agendas. I asked that decisions be documented in official channels, not spoken into his personal devices. I said it in the calm language that women use when we're trying not to be labeled. Marcus agreed in the moment, like he always did. He nodded. He made soothing sounds. He said he understood. Then he kept doing exactly what he wanted. He became subtle about it. Sometimes he wouldn't put the phone on the table. He'd keep it in his pocket, the microphone pointed up. I'd notice the slight stiffness in his posture, the way he held his jacket, and I'd know. Other times, he'd tilt his laptop screen in a way that hid the recording icon from my view. He wasn't just recording, he was teaching me that my comfort didn't matter. And the more I reacted, the more he framed it as my issue. "You seem tense," he said once, after a meeting where I'd been unusually quiet. "I'm fine," I said. He gave me that calm look. "You know, if you have nothing to hide, you don't need to worry." There it was, the oldest manipulation in the book, dressed up as logic. Nothing to hide. It wasn't about hiding. It was about consent. It was about dignity. It was about being treated like a colleague, not a suspect. But in his world, concern was guilt. Discomfort was weakness. Boundaries were an admission that you were capable of wrongdoing. As the months went on, the project I'd been hired to stabilize got worse before it got better, which is normal when you actually fix something instead of pretending it's fine. That meant hard conversations. That meant escalating issues to leadership. That meant telling Marcus and others that their strategy was failing. And every time I did, I could feel him collecting it. Not just the information, but my tone, my phrasing, the exact moment my voice sharpened. The archive was becoming a weapon with a timeline. The first time I felt it used against me was in a leadership meeting with the head of sales and the regional director. The client had threatened to terminate the contract. Everyone was trying to position themselves as the reasonable adult in the room. I presented the recovery plan. I was calm, direct. I explained where the failures were without making it personal. I recommended a scope reset, a governance change, and a direct apology to the client. The regional director asked if we had missed any early warning signs. Before I could answer, Marcus leaned forward slightly and said, "We did discuss the risk months ago." He looked at me as he spoke, like he was offering me an opportunity to agree. I frowned. "We flagged risks," I said carefully, "but the scope decisions were made elsewhere." Marcus nodded, still calm. "Yes, but I remember you said at the time that we could manage it without changing the scope." My mouth went dry. I hadn't said that. Not like that. I might have said we could manage certain issues temporarily while we gathered more data. I might have said we could stabilize while we negotiated. But I hadn't given him a green light. Before I could respond, Marcus added, "I have the recording if needed, just for clarity." The room went quiet for a second. It wasn't dramatic. It was worse than dramatic. It was clinical, like he'd put a scalpel on the table. The head of sales laughed awkwardly, trying to lighten it. "We don't need to go that far." But the damage was done. The message was clear. Marcus had proof, and I had my memory. I felt my face heat up, but I kept my voice steady. "I'd be happy to review any documentation," I said. "We should always keep decisions in official channels." Marcus smiled again, like I'd said something charming. After the meeting, my hands were shaking slightly as I typed notes. Not because of fear, exactly. Because of the specific kind of disgust that comes from being cornered in a polite room. The kind of disgust that makes you want to scrub your skin. I emailed Sabine in HR again, more directly this time. I told her Marcus had referenced recordings in a leadership meeting. I told her it was affecting my ability to do my job. I told her I wanted guidance. Sabine responded 2 days later with a short message about aligning expectations and ensuring all parties feel comfortable. She offered to set up a mediation meeting. Mediation. As if Marcus and I were having a misunderstanding about office plants. I agreed anyway, because saying no would look like I didn't want resolution. The mediation meeting took place in a neutral room with a soft gray carpet and a small bowl of mints no one touched. Sabine sat between us like a referee. Marcus arrived exactly on time, dressed impeccably. He looked calm, almost bored. Sabine asked me to explain my concerns. I did carefully. I said I felt uncomfortable being recorded without clear consent. I said it created a chilling effect. I said it undermined trust. I said I wanted clarity on policy and a commitment to stop. Marcus listened, hands folded. Then he spoke in the tone of a man explaining something simple to a child. "I never intended to make anyone uncomfortable," he said. "I record for accountability. I've been in situations where people later deny what they said. This protects everyone. It's actually fair." He looked at Sabine. "And to be clear, I never share these recordings. They're private. They are for my own reference, the same way someone takes notes." Sabine nodded slowly, as if that comparison made sense. I felt anger rise again, hot and familiar. "Notes aren't the same as recordings," I said. "A recording captures everything, tone, hesitation, it's not neutral." Marcus's expression shifted slightly, not to anger, but to something more dangerous. A faint disappointment, like I was proving him right. "I think this is about trust," he said. "And if there's no trust, we should ask why." There it was, the pivot, turning my concern into an accusation against me. Sabine asked if Marcus could agree to inform people before recording. Marcus smiled politely. "Of course." He said it like he was granting a favor. We left the meeting with a vague agreement. He would try to be transparent, and I would communicate if I felt uncomfortable. Nothing was enforced. Nothing was written as policy. The next week, Marcus recorded a meeting with me without telling me. I only realized halfway through because I saw the reflection of his phone screen in the glass wall behind him. The red dot. Small, steady, undeniable. I stopped talking mid-sentence. Marcus looked at me. "What? You're recording," I said. He blinked as if surprised. "Oh, yes, sorry, habit." Habit? Like biting nails, like tapping a pen, like forgetting your keys? He made it sound accidental. But the phone was positioned perfectly, angled toward me. Something in me snapped, not loudly but internally, a quiet refusal. "Then I'm done," I said, standing up. Marcus's eyes narrowed slightly. "Done with what?" "This meeting," I said. "We agreed you would inform me. You didn't. I'm not speaking while you record." For the first time, I saw a flash of something behind his calmness. Irritation. Not rage, but annoyance at being denied. He looked at his phone, then back at me. "You're being dramatic." That word, dramatic, the label that turns a boundary into a flaw. I felt my throat tighten, but I forced myself to stay steady. "No," I said, "I'm being clear." I left the room. My heart was hammering. I could feel people's eyes as I walked through the office, because leaving a meeting like that is visible. It creates a story. People imagine the dialogue even if they didn't hear it. Within an hour, Marcus sent me a message asking me to reset and continue the meeting. I didn't respond. The next day, he escalated. He sent an email to Sabine and copied the regional director, saying he was concerned about my emotional reactions and my resistance to accountability practices. He said he wanted to ensure the project didn't suffer because of communication style issues. Reading that email, I felt my hands go cold. He wasn't just recording, he was shaping a narrative about me. Unstable, defensive, difficult, and he had an archive to support whatever version he wanted to tell. I replied, professionally, stating facts. I said we had agreed he would inform me before recording. I said he had not done so. I said I was willing to continue meetings if recordings stopped or were done with explicit consent and stored in official channels. Marcus replied with one line, calm, deadly. I have recordings that show your agreement. That sentence made me feel physically sick. Not just because he claimed it, but because I knew he had something. Maybe not what he said, but something. A moment where I'd nodded, a moment where I'd tried to stay calm, a moment where I'd said something like, fine, because I was tired and didn't want to fight. He could slice those moments out and frame them as consent. That's how archives work. They don't need to be true. They need to be plausible. I started documenting everything on my side. I wrote emails summarizing meetings. I sent follow-ups asking for confirmation. I saved screenshots. I kept a private log with dates and times and what was said. I became my own witness. But even as I did it, I knew something ugly. In a conflict between someone's polished archive and a woman's written notes, people often believe the archive. The breaking point came when I discovered the scope of his recordings. It happened on a Thursday. Late afternoon, the office was quieting down. Marcus had asked me to help him set up a new reporting dashboard, and he wanted it clean, which meant he wanted me to do it while he took credit later. We were in his office. He had his laptop open, and he asked me to pull a file from a shared drive. While he stepped out to take a call, he left his screen unlocked. I didn't intend to snoop. I wasn't searching. I was just trying to find the folder he'd mentioned. And in the process, I clicked the wrong tab. It opened a directory on his computer, labeled simply Records. Inside were subfolders by month. Inside those were files with names that made my stomach drop. My name, my meeting dates, client names, internal projects, even casual conversations. There were recordings going back months, maybe longer, not just of me, of other managers, of junior employees, of vendor calls, of informal chats in hallways that had somehow become audio files. I stared at the list, my breath shallow. The room felt suddenly too small, like the air was thick. It wasn't accountability, it was surveillance. And I realized something else. Something that made my skin crawl. If he had recorded informal conversations, that meant he was recording when people didn't even know a meeting was happening, when someone thought they were venting privately, when someone trusted him. And when Marcus came back into the office, I didn't even try to hide my face. He looked at me and seemed to understand immediately. He didn't panic, he didn't rush, he didn't apologize. He walked to his desk, glanced at the screen, and then looked at me with that calm expression, like I was the one who had done something wrong. You shouldn't be in there, he said. I felt something rise in my throat, a mix of nausea and rage. How many people have you recorded? I asked. Marcus's voice stayed even. I told you, it's for accountability. No, I said, and my voice shook despite me. This is an archive. He leaned back slightly. You're overreacting. Overreacting again. I could feel my pulse in my ears. You have recordings of hallway conversations, I said, of people who don't know. That's not accountability, that's insurance. For the first time, Marcus's calmness hardened. He lowered his voice slightly, as if we were discussing something confidential. You should be careful with accusations, he said. It can damage reputations. He didn't mean his, he meant mine. In that moment, I understood exactly what he was doing. He was warning me that if I tried to expose him, he would expose me first with whatever he had captured. He didn't have to invent anything. He just had to edit. I left his office feeling like I was going to vomit. The hallway looked unreal, too bright, too sharp. I went into the restroom and locked myself in a stall, hands trembling. I didn't cry. I couldn't. I just sat there breathing, trying to keep my body from collapsing. When I realized I'd been archived, I felt physically sick, because it wasn't just that I'd been recorded. It was that he had been collecting me like evidence for a case I didn't know I was in. After that day, I couldn't pretend it was manageable. I couldn't tell myself it was a quirky habit. I couldn't treat it like a communication issue. Marcus had created a private surveillance system inside a workplace, and he had done it with the confidence of someone who believed he would never be punished. That confidence didn't come from arrogance alone. It came from experience. The next morning, I requested a formal meeting with HR, not Sabine alone, but with her manager present. I used the kind of language that forces attention: compliance risk, employee consent, data protection, reputational exposure. I didn't threaten. I didn't dramatize. I framed it as danger to the company. That's the thing you learn. Sometimes your dignity doesn't matter to institutions. Their risk does. The HR manager, a man named Holger, listened with a stiff expression that suggested he'd already heard some version of the story. Marcus had likely prepared him. Marcus always prepared. I described what I'd seen: folders by month, files labeled with names, recordings of conversations beyond formal meetings. I said I believed employees and clients could be affected. I said I wanted an internal investigation and immediate instruction to stop all recordings. Holger asked if I had proof. I hesitated. I hadn't taken screenshots. I hadn't recorded the directory. In that moment in Marcus's office, I'd been too shocked, too focused on getting out without looking like the criminal. I saw it, I said. I can describe it, dates, name conventions. Holger nodded slowly, then asked the question that made my stomach twist. Is it possible you misunderstood what you saw? I stared at him. That was the institutional reflex: doubt the witness, protect the system. I didn't misunderstand, I said, my voice low. He has an archive. Sabine shifted uncomfortably. Holger folded his hands. He said they would look into it. And then he said something that told me exactly how the company planned to handle it. In the meantime, it would be best to keep communication professional and calm, he said. We want to avoid escalation. Avoid escalation, meaning don't make noise, don't force us to act publicly. I left the meeting with no clear outcome, no written instruction, no assurance. The next week was hell, but not in a dramatic way, in a quiet, corrosive way. Marcus became polite, excessively polite. He put everything in writing suddenly, but in a way that twisted reality. He sent emails summarizing meetings in ways that made me sound unreasonable. He praised my work publicly while undermining me privately. He asked other managers to support me, which meant he framed me as struggling, and then the whispers started. People began acting slightly different around me, not openly hostile, just cautious, like they didn't want to be pulled into something, like they were watching to see who would win. That's when I realized Marcus had already told his story, and his story was simple. I was unstable, and he was protecting himself. At the same time, the project recovery plan began to work. The client calmed down, the governance reset helped, delivery improved, my work was producing results. But Marcus didn't care about results if he couldn't control the narrative around them. One Friday, Holger called me into a meeting. Marcus was there too. Holger said they had spoken with Marcus, and that Marcus had agreed to stop recording without consent. Marcus nodded, looking calm and cooperative. Then Holger said they considered the matter resolved. Resolved, just like that. I felt my jaw tighten. What about the existing recordings? I asked. Holger blinked slowly. Marcus assures us they are for personal reference and will not be used improperly. I looked at Marcus. His face was neutral, almost kind. I can delete them, Marcus said, like a generous man offering a concession. If it makes you feel better. If makes you feel better. My hands were clenched under the table. Not just mine, I said, all of them. Marcus's eyes hardened slightly. I don't know what you think you saw, he said calmly, but you're making assumptions. Holger cleared his throat, uncomfortable. We don't have evidence of wrongdoing beyond a misunderstanding of process, he said. Misunderstanding. Process. It was all being sanitized into something small. I left that meeting feeling hollow. Not defeated exactly, but aware. Aware that the institution wasn't going to protect me. Aware that Marcus had navigated this kind of thing before. Aware that the company's priority was quiet, not justice. After that, I stopped trying to win inside that system. I started planning my exit. I did my job meticulously. I documented everything. I kept my tone calm. I avoided being alone with Marcus as much as possible. When he requested one-on-ones, I asked to include a third person for alignment. I communicated with him mostly in writing. I made my work undeniable. And still, the tension sat in my body like a bruise. Even when Marcus wasn't recording, I felt recorded. That's what surveillance does. It doesn't end when the device turns off. It ends when you leave the environment that made it possible. The final blow came a month later when a colleague, a younger woman from finance, pulled me aside near the coffee machine. Her face was pale, her eyes darting. "Is it true Marcus records people?" she whispered. I felt something cold move through me. "Why?" I asked. She swallowed. "He mentioned he had a file from last year," she said. "From when I complained about workload, he said it proved I agreed to take on extra tasks." My stomach dropped. He was using it, not officially, not openly, but as leverage, as quiet blackmail. That was the moment I realized the archive wasn't just insurance against me. It was against everyone. He used it like a private HR department, one that answered only to him. I told her to document everything. I told her to keep communication written. I told her to talk to HR if she felt safe. But even as I spoke, I knew what those words sounded like. Survival tactics, not solutions. 2 weeks later, I resigned. I framed it as a career move, a new opportunity, a better fit. I didn't mention Marcus in my official exit interview because I knew how that story would be handled. It would become a personality conflict. It would become my bitterness. It would become his calm denial. I left quietly because I wanted to keep my dignity intact, even if the system didn't deserve my silence. On my last day, Marcus stopped by my desk. He looked almost warm. "Good luck," he said. "I think this is for the best." I looked at him and felt that old nausea rise. The archive was still out there, even if he promised it wasn't. The recordings were still somewhere, labeled and sorted and ready to be used when convenient. I wanted to tell him what he was. I wanted to call him what he deserved. I wanted to make a scene that would force everyone to look. But I didn't. I smiled politely. I said, "Thank you." And I walked out of that building with my laptop bag over my shoulder, my badge deactivated, my work reduced to files someone else would claim. Outside, Berlin was cold and bright. The air hit my face like a slap, clean and sharp. I stood for a moment on the sidewalk, watching people move past me, living their lives unaware of the tiny private wars happening behind office glass. For weeks after, I caught myself editing my thoughts as if a microphone was still near my mouth. I'd be alone in my apartment and still choose words carefully, as if Marcus were listening. I'd open my phone and feel a flash of disgust, remembering the red dot. That's the residue, not the job loss, not the resignation, not even the betrayal. It's the way someone's need for control can crawl under your skin and stay there, long after you've left the room. He recorded everything, and even now, I sometimes wonder what version of me is still sitting in his archive, frozen in audio files waiting to be used. Not because I did something wrong, but because he needed to believe someone else would.